Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking to Robert Wolgemuth. He's a best-selling author of over 20 books, including She Calls Me Daddy and Dad's Devotional Bible, which he wrote the notes of. And he grew up as a preacher's kid in a German Mennonite family. His father was pastor. And we're welcoming him to LifeQuest today because of his book, Lies Men Believe and the Truth That Sets Them Free. Welcome to LifeQuest.
Thank you, Dwight. What fun to be on the show with you. Thank you. I love German people.
All right. Why is this book important at this time, in your opinion?
Well, it came by way of my wife, who wrote a book 16 years ago called Lies Women Believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that book has sold a million copies and more. Wow. And actually, over the years, various authors would come to her and say, you need to do or have somebody do Lies Men Believe.
She just
didn't feel like it was the right person. And then we started the date after I lost my wife in 2014.
Yeah.
And she wondered if I would be interested in doing this. And I said, absolutely, I'd love to do this. So we put Lies Women Believe down next to my blank pieces of paper and came up with an outline, the general outline, similar. But then, of course, the specifics are very different because men are different than women.
That's what I heard. Yeah, it is. Very true. And, of course, in interacting with community people, with people in church, that sort of thing, there are a lot of issues between men and women, and men have their own, and it seems to be inbred in many of them in so many ways.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you're writing this, and you really begin in the Garden of Eden and the first lies.
Yeah, and that's a really important part of all of this adventure, Dwight, in writing this book, and that is the premise to Lies Women Believe is that the serpent in the garden deceived Eve.
Mm-hmm.
But the Apostle Paul says to Timothy, his protege, Eve was deceived, but Adam was not. I mean, he says that.
Yeah.
And I have to confess, I hadn't remembered that text. Nancy mm-hmm. reminded me of it. And so we spent several weeks, my wife and me, discussing what's the approach in this book. If Adam wasn't deceived, what was he? How did this happen? And so we studied, we read, we studied again and talked about it. And the chapter called Foundations, which is at the very beginning of the book, lays out this idea. And I've had now almost 2 years to soak in this
mm-hmm.
and have spoken with many folks who I trust, whose theology is sound. And here's the conclusion that we've come to. See how this sounds. So Adam is there. The Lord, of course, had given him the instructions about the tree.
Yeah.
And apparently he had mentioned it to his wife because
right.
she was aware of it when the serpent came to her. So where was he during this conversation between his wife and the serpent? Where was he? Well, most scholars believe that he was there because he participated in the conversation. So, all right, so he's there. And the serpent is tempting his wife, and what does he do? He does nothing.
Right.
He takes the fruit. That's why we know he was there. She didn't toss it to him. He was there. He took a bite. So what was he thinking? Well, here's my thought on this, and would love for your response. Here's my thought on this. He took a bite of the fruit. He knew full well that he was doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
He was sinning. He was disobeying God. And he had decided that he'd rather disobey God than confront his wife. There's a challenge for him.
Yeah.
So he must have figured, that someday he'd be able to work this out. He crossed the bridge when he got there. So you and I sit down with men whom we have read about, heard about, know, who have done really foolish things, men in leadership, pastors,
right.
theologians, authors, who have gotten caught doing awful things.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were able to sit down with them and say, okay, you're a man of the cloth, you've been to seminary, you're the pastor of a church, you've written many books, did you know that you were doing the wrong thing? Are you Adam standing there watching your wife take a bite of the fruit and press the serpent? Did you know you were doing the wrong thing? And I would love to know. We'll never, you and I will never know. But yeah. My guess is that most guys would nod their head, maybe sheepishly, and say, yeah, I did. I knew enough to know that I was doing the wrong thing. However, I decided that someday I'd get this straightened out. I'd cross this bridge when I get there. And he delayed the reality of what he was doing and went ahead and sinned.
Yeah.
So that, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's really good. But in an instant, he probably also had a certain picture of God that was beginning to flaw a little bit.
Yeah,
and
no question.
And that leads me to the next thing, Robert, and that is you say many men believe that God is not a whole lot different from me.
Right.
And we do seem to create the Lord, God the Father, in our own image.
Yes, that's right. And artists have done this over the years, right?
Yes, I was just going to go
see
there.
You see paintings of Jesus, and he looks like he's from Des Moines.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, not from the Middle East.
And yet they wouldn't let us wear long hair in college and high school.
or beards. That's right. That's right. So A.W. Tozer said, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. So the whole first section, the first five lies, have to do with lies men believe about God. I think it's that foundational to how we live, how we act, how we interact with people, how we think. All those things start with the things that we believe about God. And, you know, even though on the cover, as you see, the largest word is lies, the most important word is truth.
Yes.
So this is lies that we believe, that you and I tend to believe or attempted to believe. But the good news is that there's truth that sets us free.
And if I can extrapolate this just a bit, I have talked to people and tried to use God as the wonderful Father as the illustration, but they've so tied up their picture of God with their flawed picture of their Father, earthly Father, that I've had people say, don't talk to me about fathers, and so I've kind of shift my illustration or my direction that is going there. And you do say something I found very interesting here. On the one hand, you say we need to very much realize something about God, realize that he's big. And then the next section on the same page, I might say, you say, but he is small.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Unpack that.
Yeah, sure. Well, if he were only big, all he would do is engender awe in me, but not wonder. I mean, not the desire for a relationship. I can't have a relationship with one of the Tetons, but I can have a relationship with someone who's small enough to sit down with me and listen to my cries, my pain, my trouble, see my tears, all of that. So he's both of those things. It's the macro and the micro.
Yeah.
God is both of those. All of those.
You refer early on to the fact that we fall into this trap of I can earn God's favor, and there's another side to that, which is kind of, if I don't, God may not allow good things to happen to me or produce bad things, which seems very close to what generations of people in various parts of the world pray to the rain god and the harvest god and all this sort of thing.
Right, sure.
And it's crept into Christian theology in some way.
It has, and it's misunderstanding of grace.
Yes.
You know, I'm grateful for my parents, my daddy, pastor of a Mennonite church, as you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
But there is this semblance of how you dress, the car you drive, the color of the car you drive.
Right.
All those things that are in place in order for God to smile at me.
Yes.
And there's nothing I can do. God's grace is that way. It's Luke 15, Dwight. The Father forgiving the Son, not because he came home, before he came home.
Yes.
And that's a hard one to get your arms around, because you and I, we're into cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
We're into, you know, what's fair, what's just. And the truth is that grace isn't any of those things. It's free, it's unmerited, and it's ours regardless.
We do have, certainly in our Western society, or in this here in North America, this idea there are many ways to God, which isn't just Western America, but it's clothed with the idea they're a very spiritual person. And then you try to define that, you know, where's Jesus in all of this, and where is, you know, the scripture, and all of a sudden the spirituality blanket seems to cover a lot of things.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, one of the reasons why I fly on airplanes, in addition to getting from point A to point B, is the joy of sitting next to strangers.
Yeah.
And, I mean, 3 days ago, I sat next to a Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and I love conversations like that.
Yes.
I tell the story in the book about sitting next to a guy who glanced over while we were flying and must have seen some of my correspondence. So as we were taxiing to the gate, sometimes you've done this, you don't start talking until like 5 minutes before you get off the plane, right? So he said, you must be one of those fundamentalists that believes Jesus is the only way.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how's that for an opening question?
Yes, right.
And I said, well, actually, I don't say that.
Uh-huh.
I got him stopped. I said, well, actually, Jesus said that. So I don't need to repeat it. I believe, because he said it, that it's true.
Uh-huh.
So, you, I mean, and with all due respect, take it up with him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that, you know, exclusive is a nasty word. Exclusive means that I'm in a country club that you can't join.
Yes.
But the claims of Christ, because he made the claims himself, are that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And, you know, it's inarguable. That's there's great joy in that. There's great freedom in that. That means I don't have to argue about how wide the line is.
Mm-hmm.
He said it. He set the boundaries, and I'm good with that.
You say on page 70 of your book, Lies Men Believe and the Truth That Sets Them Free, I am the master of my own destiny. I'm in charge of my own life. And we kind of have this mythology of I pulled myself or somebody pulled themselves up by their own bootstraps.
Correct.
And I'm not really beholden to anybody. And you jump right in with some scriptural illustrations of people like that.
Yes.
Nebuchadnezzar being one. Yeah.
Oh, my. Yeah, the scripture is full of them.
Yes.
And, you know, Romans 1
says,
God, the greatest punishment is that the Lord turns us over to our own devices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't a fiery torch from heaven that singes us. It's, all right, have it your way. That's the greatest punishment.
Yeah.
And we live in a culture that is exhibit A of exactly that.
You start to really get personal a little early on in your book. And you say, you know, one of these lies that we really accept, either verbally or subconsciously, look, I've got sins in my life. I got at least one vice. But I can hide my secret sin since it only hurts me. That never happens, does it?
No, it really doesn't. The illustration there is, I'm standing in a swimming pool, and the water is about chest deep, and I'm holding a beach ball under the surface of the water with both my hands. You can't see it, but I can feel it. I can't even scratch my nose if the thing's going to come exploding through the surface of the water. Yes, it affects me. I mean, you talk to psychologists, you talk to physicians, you talk to cancer specialists. They talk about the power of stress on our bodies,
mm-hmm.
and that is stress. Having those... And you know, I'm guilty, you're guilty, of doing things, saying things, believing things, treating people in certain ways
mm-hmm.
that would be an embarrassment if it were exposed.
Right.
And really living with that, grinding in my stomach. I hate that feeling in my stomach when there's something that I haven't confessed,
mm-hmm.
something that I haven't faced up to. That's there. It's physical. It's physiological. It kills me. It hurts me. And, you know, being set free means being set free from stuff like that. That's the cross. That's what Jesus came to free me from.
Which leads into chapter 5, and that is lies that men believe about sexuality. And too often that is very much the business of it's not really all about us.
Yeah. In fact, I talked in the lie about pornography. I talk about the fact I lived in Orlando, Florida for 17 years
mm-hmm.
and went to the parks many times. When friends come down, they want to go, you know, to the parks. And sometimes we go along, sometimes we don't. But there's one thing that I've almost never seen ever, and that's a man walking through one of those parks by himself.
Okay.
The thing about pornography is that it isolates the man. And the joy of my response to watching pornography or seeing pornography is self-gratification. There's no joy in that. Mm-hmm. There may be short-lived joy or euphoria. But what God had in mind is that my sexuality is something that I share exclusively with my wife. And there's far more joy in loving her, serving her, pleasing her, than myself. That's the point. So, pornography is an awful thing, and you know it's rampant. It's everywhere. I tell the story of the first time I saw pornography as a college student, and I had to go down 3 or 4 doors in my dorm room. Now, every time I open my laptop, there it is.
Yes.
At least an invitation to. And it's almost inescapable. So I do my best to have practical things. My goal is this is a conversation mm-hmm. between me and the reader. There's no microphone. There's no platform.
Right.
There's no podium. It's just me and him. And so what I suggest is what I call just one look. So, okay, you're walking through the concourse at an airport. You see something that's provocative to you, and you can't help but see it once, but you don't have to see it twice.
Yeah.
And I whisper to myself, somebody could probably put me in a straitjacket for this. I whisper to myself, don't look back.
Yeah.
I can't control the first look, but I can control the second one.
Yeah, and this is where this self-delusion, you know, a little bit of this or that is harmless.
Right.
But
right.
It's a first or second step.
Yeah, exactly right. Oh, yeah. That's right.
You talk about work and wealth, and you talk about worshiping stupid things is one heading that you give. And we really do that, don't we? We label ourselves and others by things, the neighborhood, the car, the career, and we put it in weird conversations where you can predict what's going to come next.
Yes, exactly. As a kid, I remember reading about the children of Israel wandering in the wilderness for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Moses goes up to the mountain, comes back down, and they're worshiping a golden calf.
Right, who brought them out of Egypt.
And I'm thinking, seriously? I mean, you guys have just been in Egypt. You've just been released from Egypt. You saw the Egyptian army swallowed up in the Red Sea. And you're worshiping this image that you just created? How is that possible? Well, it's very possible.
Yeah.
The things that I own, sometimes I'm tempted for them to own me. And for me to think of myself as gaining status because of what I own or who I am or what I wear or how I speak or how I write, all those things, the Bible calls them idols and their sin.
We have to accept that definition as Christians.
That's exactly right. We really do.
I've been talking with Robert Wolgemuth. His latest book is Lies Men Believe and the Truth That Sets Them Free. It's a Moody publication. Where can our listeners get a copy of your book, Robert?
Thank you for asking. Well, they're at bookstores all over the place, as well as your favorite online retailer, Barnes mm-hmm. & Noble, and Amazon. And we'd love for folks to get the book. If you're a wife or a sister or a mother of a man and you'd like for them to have it, my encouragement is go ahead and buy it. But then carefully give it to them, not at them.
Well said.
And then in the back of the book, I have a good friend of mine, Dr. Bill Eloff, created a discussion guide that you can go to a website, and it'll help inspire conversation between you and friends to help feel some of the stuff that you're reading about in the book.
Robert, thanks so much for being with us today on LifeQuest.
Thanks, Dwight. My pleasure. Blessings to you, friend.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.